I appreciate Brad's willingness to do double duty today. Paul and Jolynn are both homesick with sinus infections, and Brad just found out at the last minute this morning that he was leading singing, so he's doing a good job. Lesson number 32 on the story of David. Here we are in 2 Samuel chapter 19. I have given this chapter a title, Uncertainty. In order to kind of bring us up to date, or to get us at the point where we are, or to understand where we are, remember that Absalom has persuaded the men of Israel to follow him and to reject his father David as king. He has marched into the city of Jerusalem. David fled the city and went to Mahanaim for refuge. The battle took place near that city, and Absalom was killed, and all of his army was defeated. The Bible says all of Israel fled to their tents. That's in 2 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 17. That's an interesting statement. And if you study the Old Testament, particularly the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, it's in Judges a time or two, and then once in 1 Kings, you'll find that that's a common saying. It occurs about seven or eight times in all of those passages. All of Israel went, every man to his tent. It's a phrase, a saying, which means everybody fled. Everybody went away. They left the battlefield. They went running home, like we would talk about the dogs, you know. They've all went and hid under the porch. Not exactly the same thing, but sort of along the same line. It's interesting to me, at least, when I find phrases like that in the Bible that are used several times. I like to trace them down and see what all is referred to. But that's one that's on my list. They went every man to his tent. But that's what happened after the death of Absalom, their leader. They saw that they were defeated, a great host of soldiers against a little small group of 4,000 men under the leadership of David's three generals. And then, of course, after we have the defeat of Absalom, David is grief-stricken, and we begin chapter 19 in the city of Mahanaim, where David is still lingering, and this probably is some days after the previous chapter. There's an interval here. We don't know exactly how long it was. It wasn't a great long time, but it probably was several days between chapter 18 and chapter 19. I've divided chapter 19 into four different sections. And I'll give you the limitations and the title of each section if you're trying to outline this. And then at the conclusion of the lesson, I'll share some observations with you. Forgot about that slide. I've been doing without PowerPoint for a couple of weeks and forgot about it. In chapter 19, we begin with the mourning and weeping. And the first few verses of chapter 19 contains one of the most interesting speeches that Joab would ever make. Probably wouldn't be considered interesting if you were listening to it from David's point of view, but the things that he said to the king were some really hard things. Absalom is dead. David is weeping and mourning over his son in the end of the previous chapter, and now chapter 19 begins like this. Then it was told Joab, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom." You see, Joab was on the way back to the city of Mahanaim where David was. He was coming off the battlefield. All of the necessary things had been taken care of. Absalom had been buried. A great heap of stones was erected over his place of burying. Now Joab is on the way back, or perhaps as he comes into the city, the word reaches him. Someone just can't wait to tell him, goes up to him and says, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom. Then the writer adds this explanation. The victory that day was turned to mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, the king is grieved for his son. So the people went by stealth into the city that day as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. And so, in other words, instead of being a victorious returning back to the throne city, instead of coming back in a jubilant fashion, celebrating the victory, everyone is sneaking in off the battlefield, headed back home, and slipping quietly into the city as though they have been embarrassed and humiliated on the battlefield. David has set the tone for the attitude and the conduct of the people who have just fought and won a very decisive battle. Verse 4, the king covered his face and cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh Absalom, my son, my son." Now, if I could step in here and take over the narrative just a little bit, the king of the door of the king's chamber burst open and Joab stomped in and he says, "You and I have got to talk." Well, that's not exactly the way the text says it happened, but that's kind of the way I see it in my mind's eye. Verse 5, then Joab came into the house to the king and said, "Today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines, by loving those who hate you and hating those who love you. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead, then you would be pleased. Now therefore arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth even until now." There were 5 points in Joab's sermon there. Point number one, this is an embarrassment. You are embarrassing your people. You're embarrassing your soldiers. Your mighty men who have stood beside you and fought for you, who have now defeated this latest enemy, you've turned this into an embarrassment. Number two, those men have made a tremendous sacrifice for you. They have gone on to the battlefield not for themselves, but for the sake of you and your family, and even your concubines. They have risked their lives, and this is how you show your respect for them. Point number three, you've let your grief turn everything in your mind upside down because you're loving the one who hated you, and you're hating the ones who love you. Point number four, you care more for Absalom than you do for us. In fact, if Absalom were alive and we were dead, you'd be happy. Personally, I think Joab came pretty close to crossing over the line right there with that statement. Obviously, David would not have been happy if all of his people were dead. It would have been the happiest for him if Absalom were alive and everything in the kingdom was okay. And then number five, Joab says, if you do not go out and speak encouraging words of gratitude to the men who have risked their lives for you, I can promise you that before morning they're going to desert you and you won't have an army anymore. It's interesting to read some of the commentators and commentaries and see who all takes Joab's side and who all takes David's side. It's pretty evenly divided. Many of them say that Joab went way too far, and there was a price to pay, and Joab paid it a little later on in this chapter. But as for me, with the exception maybe of number four, I think he hit the nail on the head. For sure, Joab was in a position as the supreme commander of the army. He was in a position where he sometimes had to say things that got close to the line. And this is one of those times. And he doesn't spare the feelings of his first cousin, King David. And it worked. Verse 8, it says, so the king rose and sat in the gate. You remember that's where the king was supposed to be. He was not in the throne city of Jerusalem, but the gate of the city was the place where everything official was supposed to take place. And so he arose and went and sat in the gate. And when they told all the people, saying, behold, the king is sitting in the gate, then all the people came before the king. Now see, you need to contrast what it says there in verse 8 with what it tells us back up there in verses 1 and 2. In verses 1 and 2, everybody's coming in from the battle and they're just kind of sneaking in with their heads down like they're embarrassed. In verse 8, the word gets out. The king is in the gate. And so everybody comes and assembles there before the king. The second division in this chapter begins there at verse 9, and I've identified it as uncertainty and hesitancy on the part of the elders and the leaders of God's people. You really have to study this carefully to sort out who's who. And incidentally, it's important to understand that in this chapter and the previous two chapters, whenever the word or the term Israel is used, it's usually referring to all of those who supported Absalom. So it was basically Israel and Absalom against David and his little handful of supporters. It's actually the latter part of verse 8 where the paragraph break occurs in the New American Standard. Now Israel had fled each to his tent. There's that phrase again reminding us that after the battle, Israel, all of the folks who supported Absalom, had turned tail and run. All the people were quarreling throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, but now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. However, Absalom, whom we anointed over us, and incidentally, that's the only place that it's referred to in Scripture of Absalom being anointed as king over Israel. And it says there that we anointed him over us. It's not clear whether that's just a phrase of symbolism or whether there really was an anointing ceremony held, but this is the only reference to Absalom being anointed king. Whom we anointed over us has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back? Now, let's understand what this is about. This is the people. This is the common people, members of every tribe throughout the land. It's evidently been talked up over the last few days. And apparently the leaders, the elders of the people, those who had originally been swayed and persuaded to follow after Absalom, it's clear that they're a little bit hesitant now, as though they don't quite know what to do. Do we open our arms up to King David? Why, he may spit in our faces after what we've done. Do we send a message telling him to come on home? Maybe he'll send us a message back telling us some things that he wants out of us first. I can understand very well the hesitance on the part of the leaders of God's people who have just been so seriously led astray by Absalom. You've seen it in your own experience. Perhaps you've come to a point at odds with another person. And then perhaps that situation is remedied. Maybe you've apologized, or he's apologized, or both have apologized. But you know, there's a lot of times there's still a little bit of that uneasy feeling. You know, who's going to take the first step back? Recently, I was preaching in a place and I saw a controversy take place. I knew, didn't know what it was, but I knew there was something going on between two of the brethren there. And then the next night, it was in a gospel meeting. The next night, as soon as services were over, without a word of preface or anything like that, those two guys at the back of the building just walked up to one another without a word and threw their arms around each other and hugged each other. And I knew the situation had been solved. I knew the problem had been remedied. Never did know what the problem was. But you know, sometimes it's not always easy to say, okay, everything's fine now, because a lot of times it's difficult for everything to be fine. And that's one reason why I've entitled this chapter Uncertainty, because there's that uneasiness on the part of both parties. And so in that paragraph that we just read, it appears to me that the people want an answer. They want an answer from the elders, who in the absence of the king are to be taking the leadership here. And they say, what are we waiting on to get the king back in his rightful place? What's holding everything up? And then beginning in verse 11, it appears that King David also senses a little bit of uneasiness and uncertainty and hesitance on the part of the leaders, and so the king wants an answer too. And King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house? You are my brothers, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? Well, I think part of the reason was because they were among the first to send the king away, even from the tribe of Judah. Verse 13. Say to Amasa. Amasa. Who's that? Back in chapter 17, verse 25, Amasa is identified as the one who was the captain of Absalom's army. It also tells us in that place that Amasa was also a cousin of David. Say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more also if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. David, what in the world are you thinking? What is in your mind? Verse 14. Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king, saying, return, you and all your servants. You know, one thing I've noticed about King David, and you may have noticed this too, it seems like at least more than once or twice in this story, when he's gotten into a sticky situation or a delicate situation, maybe he tends to kind of overcompensate and fix things a little bit too well. Remember Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, who came to David and told the lie about Mephibosheth waiting to be restored to a position of power under the rule of Absalom, when actually he just saddled his donkey and rode off and left Mephibosheth, who was crippled. But David was took in by that story, and so David said, all of the land and all of the servants of Mephibosheth are yours from now on. That was a little hasty. We'll see more about that in a few minutes. Here, it appears to be a token gesture toward Amasa and toward the men of Judah to persuade everybody, let's get things back normal. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to get rid of old Joab. Boy, you ought to hear what he told me a while ago. And I want Amasa. Yeah, Amasa, the traitor. The one who led the army against me. Yeah, I want him to be my commanding general. And everybody was glad to hear it. Come on back home. The king returned and came as far as the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal in order to go and meet the king, to bring the king across the Jordan. Section number 3 is the welcoming party, and in this section we'll see several guys identified that we already know, and we'll find a little bit more out about them here. Verse 16, then Shimei, the son of Gera. Remember old foul-mouthed Shimei? The guy who could throw a curveball with a rock, you know, and the guy who prided himself in throwing dirt clods at the king as the king was fleeing from the city, running along on the levee above him, throwing dirt and cursing, telling David, this is just what you deserve. Yes, that's old Shimei, the Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. And Ziba, remember Ziba, we talked about him a minute ago, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him, and they rushed to the Jordan before the king. And verse 18 says, then they kept crossing the ford to bring the king's household over and to do what was good in his sight. You know what that means? These two guys were falling all over themselves trying to do everything they could in a positive way to get back in the king's favor. Especially Shimei. The King James Version, incidentally, says there was a ferry boat there. New American Standard just says they kept crossing the ford, the place made so that you could go back and forth across the river. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he said to the king, let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord the king came out of Jerusalem, so that the king would take it to heart. For your servant knows that I've sinned. Therefore, behold, I've come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king. But Abishai, my best friend Abishai, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said, should not Shimei be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? Abishai's cooled off just a little bit. He wanted to cut Shimei's head off the first time. Now he just talks about putting him to death. David then said another phrase that's given, I think, three times in the story of David. What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? For do I not know that I am king over Israel today? The king said to Shimei, you shall not die. The king swore to him. And then Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he had neither cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came home in peace. You see, old Mephibosheth was so tickled about David leaving that he'd just taken leave of his senses. He'd just quit taking care of all of his personal hygiene in celebration of the fact that David was gone. How much sense does that make? That was Ziba's story. But we know that Ziba was lying. Ziba said Mephibosheth was glad that David was gone. But it's obvious that the inspired writer styles this thing as Mephibosheth being in deep mourning. It was when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" So he answered, "Oh, my lord the king, my servant deceived me, for your servant said, 'I'll saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king, because your servant is lame. Moreover, he has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your sight.'" That's another phrase that's said at least two times of David, as though the one talking to him gave him credit for being miraculous in the things that he could know from the hearts of other people. "For all my father's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king, yet you set your servant among those who ate at your own table. What right do I have yet that I should complain any more to the king?" In other words, well, maybe not in other words, maybe this is the way I would have said it. "Even though you've given all of my land away to this guy who lied about me, even though you've given all of my servants to him, I'm not worried about those things. That's nothing compared to the joy that I have with your return." So the king said to him, "Why do you still speak of your affairs? I have decided you and Ziba shall divide the land." Mephibosheth said to the king, "Let him even take it all, since my lord the king has come safely to his own house." Oh, that we could have the grace of Mephibosheth. What a graceful man he was. How accommodating. There doesn't seem to be any resentment. And David has again made a ridiculously rash decision. Now, Barzillai, the Gileadite, had come down from Rogelim. He's identified back in chapter 17, verse 27, as one of, I think, three very wealthy or powerful men who brought vessels and food and drink and beds and bedding and everything that David and his company needed to the city of Mahanaim. He furnished all of the necessities while David was there, having fled from Jerusalem. And he went on to the Jordan with the king to escort him over. And Barzillai was very old, being 80 years old. And he had sustained the king while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very great man. And the king said, "You cross over with me and I'll sustain you in Jerusalem with me." But he said, "Oh, king, I don't need to do that. I'm an old man. I can't taste my food. I can't hear what people say. I can't see well enough to appreciate things. Give me a pass on this. Let me just go back to my familiar town." Tell you what, though, if you feel that strongly about it, here's my son. Let my son go with you. do to him whatever you see is best. Chimham was the son of Barzillai. The king answered, Chimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what is good in your sight. And whatever you require of me, I will do for you. And all the people crossed over the Jordan, and the king crossed too. The king then kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his place. Now, very quickly, the fourth section of this chapter, you could call it uncertainty and controversy, I suppose, if you wanted to give it a name. Now, the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him, and all the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel accompanied the king. One commentator commented on that particular statement, and he says, for Israel it was a half-hearted thing. For Judah it was a whole-hearted effort. And I would have a hard time arguing with that reasoning. Behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over the Jordan? Come on, guys. Get real. You're going to fuss about the fact that the tribe of Judah had more people to go out and help David and his company come back across the Jordan to come back home. You're feeling left out because only half of you went out to meet the king instead of all of you, like all of the tribe of Judah. And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a close relative to us. Why then are you angry about this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense, or has anything been taken for us? But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 parts in the king, therefore we also have more claim on David than you. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring back our king? In other words, if we hadn't put up the fuss with our elders to get them to bring him back, he'd still be out there in Mahanaim. You need to give us credit for this. And yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Maybe it means that Judah won the argument. At any rate, this chapter ends on this note of controversy. And when we study the next chapter, next Sunday night, we'll see how that the situation was ripe for just exactly what happened. Now let's look at 3 observations very quickly, and we'll be finished. Number one. Leaders must always be conscious of the effect, you could put the word impression there for effect, that is rendered by their deeds and their words, even in cases where there may not be anything wrong with their deeds or their words inherently, it might not be an appropriate time for certain things to be done or said. David was a father. He loved his son very much. We can't take that from him. Every one of us who has a son can somehow sympathize to some degree, whether we've lost a child or not. We understand a little bit of how David could become so distracted in his grief, but he was the king. And the demonstration that he put on before the eyes of the returning army was absolutely inappropriate. You say, well, that's not fair. That's an interesting word. Fair. It seems to be the one that we bounce to when we don't know what else to say. Nobody ever promised that everything would be fair. And one of the peculiarities of leadership, whether it's the king, whether it's a leader in the church, whether it's a leader of our nation, wisdom is needed, and consideration needs to be given. Some things might not need to be said because of an impression that they might. I'm not talking about right and wrong here. I'm not talking about holding back from saying something that needs to be said. I'm talking about the appropriateness of a situation. Leaders have to be especially conscious of that. Number two, Christians must never allow anything or anyone to divert their focus from serving God. Are you saying that you can't grieve over a lost loved one? No, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying that if we neglect our duty to God to the extent that it begins to affect us and those around us and our influence, our effectiveness, it's wrong. We must not let anyone or anything. David allowed his particular love for Absalom to sway him away from his responsibility to his people, not just in this chapter, but several times since the story of Absalom began. And then number three, after sin and restoration, everyone has to work hard to keep things right. We saw it mentioned at least twice in this chapter. Great sin had been committed by allowing Absalom to rise and lead on the part of those who followed him. But now, everything had been taken care of. Now is the time to forgive and to restore. And as we've already mentioned, forgiveness and restoration sometimes is a little bit delicate because we're human, because we're people. Those who have sinned need to truly repent. Those who've been sinned against need to truly forgive. That's the only way the process will work. You want a New Testament illustration of that? Turned out a little bit differently. But look at Luke chapter 15, the story of the prodigal son. Especially in the elder brother, there is an illustration of one who had been, in a sense, transgressed against, who had a bad attitude toward the one who had sinned, but who had come back seeking to be restored. No matter which side we find ourselves on in a situation like that, both sides have tremendous responsibilities. And we dare not shirk our responsibility. Next Sunday night, Lord willing, we'll go one more chapter or two, depending on how everything works out, as we near the end of the story of David. And you may notice that our story has turned really, it's still exciting, but it's not exciting in such a good way anymore, is it? Very interesting couple of stories left to cover. If you're subject to our Lord's invitation in any way, we invite you to respond as we stand together and sing this song.